Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is USDA Deputy Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small, who offers us an update from the Department of Agriculture. But first, here's this week's headlines. Action on Capitol Hill is at a minimum as the House of Representatives worked through its second week without a speaker. A plurality of House Republicans backed Louisiana's Steve Scalise in a closed-door meeting Wednesday, but many members were quick to note their plans to maintain support for Jim Jordan. The Ohio Republican came in second to Scalise in the GOP conference vote. The last time the House voted on a new speaker, California Republican Kevin McCarthy needed 15 rounds of voting to get a sufficient level of support. Grocery prices ticked up slightly higher in September's Consumer Price Index. Consumers paid 0.1% more at the checkout line last month, driven largely by increases in the prices for beef, pork, and milk. All told, grocery prices are now 2.4% higher than in September 2022, bringing food price inflation back to historic trends after last year's much larger increases. The overall CPI was up 0.4%, due in large part to increased costs for housing and gasoline. And finally, the Department of Agriculture announced $60 million in funding for projects to improve school lunches across the country. The funding is split between an effort to improve training that will allow cooks to work with higher quality food while keeping costs under control, and a separate effort to use more local ingredients in the meals. USDA's Food and Nutrition Service also rolled out a new farm-to-school census to periodically survey school districts on their local food procurement efforts. FNS is one of several USDA agencies now under the purview of Xochitl Torres-Small, who was just shy of 3 months into a job as USDA's number two official, giving her oversight of a larger array of programs than her previous rural development portfolio. As she oversees a bigger workforce, some of her concerns have remained consistent.
When I was Undersecretary for Rural Development, the thing that kept me up at night the most was our workforce, and specifically that about a third were eligible to retire within the next 5 years. And that's a lot of experience that is ready to walk out the door. And it also presents an opportunity, if we're doing things right during this period, to invest in training for the next generation of USDA employees who'll be working in the communities they live all across the country for rural people. Or if you look at FPAC, for example, and FSA offices, the trusted partner with farmers, or NRCS, folks who are going out to the field and working to provide that training, that consultation, and then also those funds through agreements. That's why it's so important that we invest in our workforce at this time. And as we look at, for example, the House budget for USDA, it gives me a lot of heartburn about how we do that based on some of the conversations about funding that we're looking at. And just frankly, in that case, wholly insufficient funding. So one of the exciting points that I see here is Congress's investment through the Inflation Reduction Act. That as we're doing this work to build new, more, and better markets for farmers and support work that's already being done on the ground to make sure farmers get credit for the climate smart practices they're doing, we can also invest in that workforce that's delivering those programs. So NRCS, for example, has a plan to hire over 4,000 new employees to get out the Inflation Reduction Act funds. Well, by doing that, they're also preparing, they're having that succession planning that's really crucial for that large percentage of the workforce that is prepared to retire. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned your former RD cohort, that one-third within 5 years. I do wonder, as you look perhaps now, given your new role with broader oversight over the USDA workforce, looking across all of the various agencies and departments within USDA, are there any that jump out at you in terms of folks that are, with a greater percentage nearing retirement and concerns about filling those roles with new candidates once those folks do end up retiring?
Rural development is on the higher end across the spectrum, but by and large, almost all of the mission areas are within that quarter to third spectrum. And so there's a challenge across the board and frankly, an opportunity across the board to plan for that training.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned now the fact that you've got between, 25 and 33% of the workforce in all these areas nearing the retirement age. What's your candidate pool look like for replacements?
It's a very good question, and certainly it depends on the type of job that we're looking at. But I will go back to NRCS as a clear example. So one of the challenges that we're seeing is that a lot of the university courses that existed generations ago that helped us fill our workforce in the past, some of that curriculum has changed, and it's not a perfect match with what we're looking for soil scientists, for example. And so we're working closely with universities to build a stronger pipeline, to make sure that the courses are offered that we need, but then also to see if there are flexibilities to find ways for potential employees to access those courses later.
Mm-hmm. In terms of inter-office attendance, is this an area where you think farmers and ranchers are going to be able to be satisfied with their ability to, get face-to-face interaction with somebody at the county level or perhaps a rural development officer maybe at the state or federal level? In terms of broader interoffice attendance, are folks coming back to the buildings?
Rural development, also at FSA, offices are open. Offices are open with the same office hours that you experience. At the same time, whether it's a FSA office, you also have folks who might be going out to the field to interact. Or if it's an RD office, folks who are going to City Hall in order to meet customers where they're at. It's crucially important to make sure that those offices continue to operate in that way that people have relied on for so long. What we've seen is that folks do also, in terms of retaining that workforce, folks want that flexibility. So if we can find ways to keep the office open, to make sure there's still someone that someone can talk to when they walk in that door, but also if someone is following up on processing a loan application and can do that from another place remotely, there's a chance to do both and then provide some flexibility on the workforce, which helps with recruitment, especially in with the challenges with labor right now, while also providing the service that's necessary.
We'll have more from USDA's Xochitl Torres-Small right after this.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. Amidst an ongoing debate about the use of climate smart funding in the Inflation Reduction Act, USDA Deputy Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small says the money can be well spent exactly where it is.
It's a continued investment in programs that farmers already know and love. It's also a continued investment in work that farmers are doing and making sure they get credit for that work when it comes to practices that are fighting climate change, fighting the drought that they may be experiencing or wildfires that are increasingly happening, and making sure farmers are able to build a marketplace as well. So they're getting a fair share of their food dollar because of their work that they're doing. So we see these investments as really valuable. We've also seen it's crucial that Congress pass a farm bill, and we're doing everything we can to support that in terms of providing technical assistance that they request. But we see the Inflation Reduction Act as a specific investment in the future of agriculture, and we're putting that money to good use already.
Mm-hmm. On the farm bill, we have seen the September 30th deadline come and go. No new legislation at this point. Really, the conventional wisdom says the end of the year is the more effective deadline. But absent some kind of conversation on that, at what point do USDA employees begin conversations on the potential implementation of permanent law?
many of the impacts will happen later on in the year. Listen, you know, there is an immediate need for Congress first to pass a budget, because the biggest challenge is if we don't get a budget, you know, being able to provide that technical assistance that's necessary for the Farm Bill is going to be exceptionally challenging, right? We're just with the potential lapse in funding that we saw just a few weeks ago, so much time is put into having to prepare for that, for the impact that we'll have. We just finished talking, for example, about the importance of farmers being able to walk into their FSA office. If there's a lapse in funding, those offices would be closed. So first, you know, we know that Congress has a lot of things they need to do, and then we will be here to provide the technical assistance necessary to get a Farm Bill reauthorized.
Wrapping up here, have there been any conversations at this point between USDA and Capitol Hill in terms of what a extension of the current law might look like, in terms of, you know, any potential changes within that extension, the timeframe of it, any conversations at this point?
Yeah, we're here and providing technical assistance as it's requested of Congress. And certainly as a former member of Congress, I know that it's Congress that writes the Farm Bill, Congress that would do an extension, and certainly here to support them as they navigate that.
Deputy Secretary Torres-Small, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to see you.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Quentin Slater has a look at the agricultural job market in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
The number of agricultural jobs across the country has been steadily climbing since 2010, according to figures from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. This chart shows the number of people hired in agriculture and support industries since 2001. Results are shown across four areas: livestock, livestock support, crops, and crop support. According to BLS, employment rose 6% between 2012 and 2022. A total of 70,000 jobs were added across the four categories. 27,500 jobs were added in crop support services, which was an increase of 12%. More than 31,000 jobs were added in the livestock sector, which is an increase of 10%. Our Jackie Fatga took a deep dive into workforce issues facing American agriculture. If you're interested in learning more, you can read her articles on our website, agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Quentin Slater.
Who mapped the soybean genome? You did. Who's replacing the petroleum and asphalt? You are. Who created biodiesel that increased your income 63 cents per bushel? You again. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff, moving soy forward, moving you forward.
At Clean Fuels Alliance America, we're working toward a future of clean energy now that will make our members proud. We serve as the clean fuels industry's primary organization for technical, environmental, and quality assurance programs, and are the strongest voice for its advocacy, communications, and market development. With industry-leading programs and incentives, Clean Fuels Alliance America is actively moving the clean fuels industry forward toward a brighter future.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. We're going to have a conversation about just what it is that is going on Capitol Hill these days and how folks are trying to sort their way through it as they interpret the possible implications on farm policy. And we're joined for that conversation by Danielle Beck with Invariant and John Weber with Monument Advocacy. Appreciate you both of you taking the time. And Danielle, I want to go to you first because, you know, I think it's interesting to kind of look at sort of the multi-client side of Washington, D.C. right now for this conversation in particular, because I have to wonder, when clients reach out to you trying to make heads or tails of what some of the upheaval that we've seen recently in the House Republican Conference means and its potential implications, what broadly are the answers you're offering to clients at this point?
So Invariant has said to all of our clients in the Food and Ag Practice Group, basically since day one, or since I started at the firm, that the likelihood of passing a farm bill in 2023 is slim. We think first quarter of 2024, or that first half of the year, makes far more sense from a timing perspective, and we're continuing to do the work. I mean, the current upheaval in the House of Representatives has not stopped staff from writing the bill, from having these conversations internally, bipartisan negotiations. As long as they're continuing to work, we are going to continue working. And so really, it hasn't changed the trajectory. The other thing I would say is that really, these are unprecedented times, but Congress has a way of figuring it out. I think every single farm bill that I've worked on, It always seems like it's going to be the last. There's always some sort of drama, but at the end of the day, Congress finds a way to get it done.
Mm-hmm. So then looking at, you mentioned that the work is still, you know, continuing at the staff level, you know, folks are still trying to get legislation complete. We are seeing in some of these conversations, some of the more hardline conservative members making demands for things like spending cuts, possibly some programmatic changes. Obviously, it'll be a while before the dust fully settles on all of those demands and all of the deals that are cut in this phase of interconference dynamics. What ultimately do you think, and what's going to be on your radar for the impacts of some of those conversations on foreign policy, specifically in the context of some of this government spending?
I think the biggest impact is how long the upheaval lasts, because the less time there is for meaningful deliberation in the House, the clock is ticking. And so, you know, any delay without an extension after the first of the year ultimately will result in real impacts on the ground to farmers and ranchers and anybody who really benefits from programs through USDA. You know, the spending conversation is certainly one to be paying attention to, but the Senate is taking a very different position. This is why we have bipartisan negotiations. Somewhere in the middle, the two shall meet.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, bringing you into the fold here, looking at some of these discussions about where the Senate's at on spending, where the House is at on spending, and where that final product ultimately will be, obviously remains to be seen at this point. But I will ask you, do you think agriculture groups should be concerned?
You know, you look at the agri-probes as kind of our real first test for a new Congress, 200 plus new members of where they're going to be on some of these poison pill amendments. And, you know, they showed a ton of fortitude in defeating those, but really in a bipartisan manner. And I think that goes back to the pathway to success and getting a farm bill done this year or next, in the first quarter next, as Danielle pointed out, is really being entirely bipartisan in the approach here. You know, leadership elections have to provide that floor time going forward. But that grassroots work started with, you know, Chairman Thompson crisscrossing the country and learning those members' priorities to build that coalition. And every coalition is different. They're going to take different forms. But I think there were some, you know, some highlights out of that agri-probes process, despite the bill not getting done.
We'll have more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. John Weber worked on the conservation title of the 2018 Farm Bill as a Hill staffer, and he says the oversubscription issues facing conservation programs might still be an issue despite Inflation Reduction Act investment.
Conservation programs have always been wildly popular. When we were doing the 18 bill, EQIP was always wildly oversubscribed, wildly popular with producers. So we funded it to the greatest degree possible. You know, I think even after the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, that still holds true. I think the policy debate is going to really come down to what are the parameters that Congress puts on what practices can be used for those pieces. House Republicans have always been adamant, farm bill after farm bill, that decisions of what conservation practices are implemented on farm are made between the farmer and their conservationist. I think there's a hesitancy to let any of that policy decision drift towards DC in determining what's climate smart and what's not. I think that's really the crux of the policy debate right now is if you look at cross requests and, you know, things that are supported by House Republicans, EQIP will always be up there. It really comes down to what's the practical impact of what's getting approved when there is such a strong demand.
Mm-hmm. What does the, in your mind and in your experience, what does the oversubscription look like? I mean, they've got this nearly $20 billion infusion that they're looking to use through the Inflation Reduction Act as it currently stands. Is that going to meet the unmet demand, to potentially exceed it? Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but we're still going to have an oversubscribed program going into this. You know, you double funding, you typically kind of cut that margin down in half. But there's still projects. There's always been the longstanding complaint that larger projects have a tougher time for approvals. Greater funding allows some of those projects at scale to be authorized, but there's still going to be that longstanding traditional implementing, you know, programs that are cover crops, precision ag, all those things that are still wildly popular. They're not on every acre in the country, and there's still an incentive for producers to work with NRCS to implement those.
So zooming out then and looking, John, at the Farm Bill, you know, generally, obviously the debate continues about whether or not that is going to be a bipartisan measure, or given some of the internal Republican upheaval that we've seen over the course of the last month, does leadership try and move a GOP-only bill with the very thin margins that they have on their side of the aisle? What ultimately do you think are going to be the factors to watch in determining which way Congress is leaning in that direction, John?
Yeah, and I think committee leadership is the first piece we can point to. And Chairman Thompson has been absolutely adamant that they're working through a bipartisan process. Getting a strong bipartisan vote out of committee is the absolute vital piece. As far as what leadership determines, I think we really need to take a step back and see what that leadership looks like first and foremost. And to Danielle's point, you know, it's all about how long does this take to clear up? I think that's going to take a while to understand, but they're going to have to take a look at their conference and see what that looks like. There's conversation over the Hastert rule of having 2/3 of the majority support the bill, and it's going to really come down to electoral, you know, math and what gets you to 218. Every pathway is different. It's all about what gets us to the conference to eventually get to a conference package. And I think members are going to have to take a step back and look at that, say, you know, what can we afford to give up for a less perfect product to get us to that next step?
Mm-hmm. Well, and Danielle, as we look perhaps broader than the specifics of farm policy and look to Congress, Congress and legislation generally, how are you going to be deciphering whether or not perhaps the new Republican leadership team is working to garner the support and cater to perhaps the more moderate wing of its party or the more conservative, the more Freedom Caucus style wing of its party? What are you going to be watching?
So 92% of planted acres in the United States are in Republican districts, regardless of who the next speaker is. I think that that is a very salient point that it benefits whoever the next speaker is to pay attention to. There's strong bipartisan support, but there's also a lot of support from both conservative Republicans and those moderates to see a farm bill enacted, to see a full year funding bill, including agriculture appropriations. And so ultimately, I believe that those who are supporting ag in Congress are going to continue driving that agenda, Chairman Thompson being top of mind, top of the list. And, you know, there's a lot that needs to happen before the end of the year. Funding is the paramount, but you know, anybody's guess is as good as mine in terms of what happens next.
Well, what does happen next? We will have to stay anxiously watching our TV screens, our social media feeds, and the like, as well as, of course, the coverage on agripulse.com to determine the answer to that question. But for now, Danielle, John, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers. But first, our Quentin Slater walks us through plans to grow the processing capacity for a key row crop.
The growing demand for soybeans and soybean oil cannot be met unless there's enough soybean crush plants. This map shows the location of soybean crushing plants across the country, according to the American Soybean Association's chief economist, Scott Gerlt. The blue dots are existing plants, the green dots are announced new plants, and the dots with the orange line around them are plants that are being expanded. Dot size represents how many thousands of bushels each plant can crush per day. Most of them are in Iowa, but there's also plants with large crushing capacity in Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. According to Gerlt, if all the announced soybean plants are built, soybean crushing capacity in the U.S. would increase by 25%. You can watch Scott's full presentation during our recent webinar on improving American infrastructure to meet demands for soy on our website, agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Quentin Slater.
Who mapped the soybean genome? You did. Who's replacing the petroleum and asphalt? You are. Who created biodiesel that increased your income 63 cents per bushel? You again. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff, moving soy forward, moving you forward.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will hold hearings Wednesday on the implications of the Supreme Court's Sackett decision for the Clean Water Act. And USDA will release several monthly reports, including milk production and cattle on feed. We'll have the latest on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.